spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. Now, oftentimes in prophecy, we find prophecies that can have more than one fulfillment, more than one meaning. But it appears that this one is a singular fulfillment, because there has never been a time when all wars have ceased and ended completely. Now, Isaiah was, as it says in the very first verse of his book, prophesied during the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. Now, that's a long experience. Those are long-reigning kings. Uzziah himself reigned, something like 52 years. But I don't think he began in the beginning of Uzziah's reign. That would be just too much. But Isaiah continued to the reign of one more king, the son of Hezekiah, who was a very good king, Hezekiah was Manasseh. And you'll see on the screen Hebrews 11:37, that refers by the Apostle Paul to the experiences of many of the ancient worthies. And he mentions just in passing this verse, 11:37, they were stoned, they were sawn asunder, they were tempted, they were slain with the sword. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, and tormented. So who was it that was sawn asunder? Now, I don't actually remember in the Old Testament reading a narrative about a prophet that was cut in two pieces. However, that appears to be what happened to Isaiah. And that happened under the reign of Manasseh. Now, that always surprises me when I hear this. But this is apparently according to Jewish tradition. Here's Ellicott's commentary on this. Quote, an ancient tradition mentioned both by Jewish and by early Christian writers relates that Isaiah was thus put to death by the order of Manasseh. Now, Manasseh was a son of Hezekiah. He knew better. And Manasseh was carried captive by one of the kings of Assyria. That was a king called Esarhaddon. We might talk about him more a little bit later. But apparently, because of his confinement, he regretted all the things he had done. And the Lord allowed Manasseh to come back and remain king of Judah. He was humbled. He was more contrite. He was better. This is remarkable to me. He had actually killed one of the prophets of God in a very egregious way. And yet God did restore him. God can be very, very merciful. He can also be very, very just. And in our own experiences, we see both aspects. Now this expression, they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks, is something that not only you know, but many Christians know and many non-Christians know. Because as you may know, this is at the United Nations. Now, I'm delighted that when the United Nations was constructed, they found such a nice text to put there. But I didn't know until I prepared for this lesson how it was that that text got there. I'm afraid that if they built the United Nations today, they might not do that. I don't know. Society is changing, not for the better. Okay, there's some better things and some worse things. But in some ways, society is changing, not for the better. So how did that get up there? Well, I found out. This is what I've got to read. Quote, they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. The scripture was gifted to the United Nations by the USSR on December 4th, 1959. That's remarkable. USSR is no longer in operation. The same people are there, same countries there, but it's no longer the same way. But I found that remarkable, that the chief adversary of the Western forces would at least agree with them to put up a placard that hoped for no more war. Now, already right now, you see there's a terrible war going on. I just feel terrible about it. The Ukraine and Russia. Well, we're not to the time of the scripture yet. We're still approaching there. I think when America went through their war when I was young, that would be the Vietnam War. I think America lost something like, 50, 60, maybe 70,000 at the most, over the whole years of the war. Ukraine has already lost, what, 100,000, something like that, just in a year. This is a terrible experience, and I'm a little surprised by it. But maybe every generation needs a little reminder to really appreciate what is the counterpart of this, and they will find that in the kingdom when all wars will finally end. We've got some more conflicts to undergo. I think because of the world wars we have been through, in the book of Kings, it talks about Elijah, and he fled to Mount Horeb, and then at Mount Horeb, God gave him a vision. He says, come to the mouth of the cave, Elijah, I've got something to show you. And he saw three things pass by. There was the wind, and then there was the earthquake, and then there was the fire. And the winds, I think, represent, and the earthquake and the fire, represent three stages of the time of trouble that we're presently in today. And the winds are usually considered to be the winds of war. Now, even in Daniel, the seventh chapter, where you find all the four empires that rise out of the sea, it says the wind strove upon the great sea, and out of it came these four empires. An empire doesn't just take over by saying, we're next, and we'll do a good job. No, they come out through war, through the winds of war that strive upon the sea, and then they say, we're in charge, and that's all there is to it. So that's the way the empires have developed. And I think that tells us the winds do represent war. Well, what's the first stage of the time of trouble since 1914? It has been the winds of war. 1914, World War I, 4 years of war that was so big they called it the Great War. That's just the Great War. But then a greater war came in 1939, so they had to relabel the first one. Let's say that was a First World War, and this is the Second World War. Are we going to have a Third World War? Well, I have an opinion, and that is that it won't be. Maybe your opinion is a little different. It's possible. We're talking opinions here. But I really think that the wind phase of the time of trouble is over. Now, since the wind phase completed, then the earthquake phase is next. So I think that earthquake phase is the breaking up of the old universal dominions. Wow, what happened after World War II is that the British Empire began to crumble. Israel got independence in 1948. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But that's not the first big country that got independence. That was India in 1947. And then much of the continent that we serve today in Africa, they got their independence in the 1960s. And then Indochina in the 1970s. And I thought that was pretty much the end of it until I was shocked to find the Soviet Union broke up in 1989 and the countries of Eastern Europe were free. So I think that's the earthquake phase. I think we've been through that. And we got one more phase, and that's the fire phase. Now that's, when you're involved in something directly, that's it's our time, we see it happening. You need a little perspective sometimes. So I'm not really quite sure how to define the fire phase. At first I thought, okay, that's the fire of Islamic insurgency, because that was the real problem in the early 1990s. But now I wonder if it's perhaps broader than that, and perhaps we have a few years to go and we'll see what else is involved. Well, we'll see. But I think we finished the war phase. So I think we have finished the time of egregious world wars. I think. Not everybody concurs with that. But I think so. But we haven't yet reached the time when there will be no more war at all. And that will be a wonderful time in the experience of history. Okay, now Isaiah. Let's see. Excuse me. Isaiah, the whole book, is really in three portions. Now, it just so happens, I don't know if this was connected with our assignment here, but it just so happens that we have been studying Isaiah in San Diego, and we're not yet finished. We got three or four verses to finish, and then we're done with the book. So that's how recent it is, our interest in this book. But it's in three parts. Now, I have heard Isaiah divided differently, so if you have seen some other division, that's fine. Maybe there's some good points to there. But I would divide it in chapters 1 through 35 as the first. Now, in these chapters, you don't find mention of a lot of threats of Israel going into Babylonian captivity. But you will find that in the last half of the book. I'll explain why we get to that point. And then starting with, in chapter 35, now this is a chapter that you all know. I mean, if you start off, you want to tell somebody about the kingdom, I wouldn't be surprised if you first turned to chapter 35. That is just beautiful. I'd like to turn there and just read part of this. Isaiah 35 is the blessing of the kingdom established when, as chapter 2 says, there'll be no more war. But this is what else will happen. This is starting in, I'm going to start with verse 5. Then the eyes of the blind shall be opened, the ears of the deaf shall be unstopped. The lame man shall leap as an hart, the tongue of the dumb shall sing. In the wilderness there shall be waters break out and streams in the desert. And skip a little bit here. A highway shall be there and a way. It shall be called the way of holiness. The unclean shall not pass over it, because they're going to be clean by the time they get to the end. But it shall be for them. The wayfaring men, though fools, they will not err therein. No lion, the great adversary, will be gone. No lion will be there. No ravenous beast shall go up thereon. It shall not be found there. The redeemed shall walk there. The ransomed of Jehovah shall return and come to Zion with songs and everlasting joy. They shall obtain joy and gladness, and sorrow and sighing will flee away. Now, if you ever want to witness to somebody about the kingdom, that's a nice chapter to start with. Now, I think all of you know that chapter. That's just fundamental to the Bible student appreciation of the better times that are coming. Now, what happens in chapter 36? Chapter 36, there's a dire emergency that hits the nation of Israel in the reign of Hezekiah. And this dire emergency threatens to destroy the whole kingdom of Judah. Now, the 10-tribe kingdom in the north has already been taken captive by the Syrians. But now the 2-tribe kingdom is left. And chapter 36 is the problem that Hezekiah faces. And in chapter 37, verse 1, it came to pass when King Hezekiah heard it, he rent his clothes, he covered himself with sackcloth, he went into the house of the Lord, he spread out the letter, and he just unveiled his heart to God and pleaded for rescue from the threat of Sennacherib and the Assyrian army that was ready to take the city. And in chapter 37, Isaiah comes to him and says, the Lord has heard you. You will be rescued. You will be delivered. Now, I think this is a little portent of the deliverance that Israel is going to receive in the kingdom. I think this is a direct picture of that deliverance. We'll talk more about this a little bit later. But you see in the book of Joel, who was a contemporary of Isaiah, that in Joel chapter 2, they're threatened deeply and finally with the last extermination. And the prophet says, declare a fast, declare an assembly. Let the priest weep between the porch and the altar. Let them kneel and say, God, save us, just save us. That's what Hezekiah did. He spread out the letter before the temple and says, just please, save us. And God will respond. And that Joel 2 is just a precious chapter. So in chapter 38, we learn in Isaiah something else that was going on while this siege was happening. Turns out that Hezekiah had another problem. Even if there was no threat on the outside, he had a medical problem that was threatening his life. And I think Israel has a medical problem that's threatening their life. Really, it's a moral problem. And that is the moral problem that everybody has, sin. Hezekiah had a big boil on his back. And you don't read about that in chapters 36 and 37. But in 38, it turns out that he had this narrative about the other threat to his life. And he actually wept over this problem. And the Lord said, I'll take care of it for you. And so how you healed that disease, the systemic disease of sin, you're going to have to wait for the ancient worthies for that. So you take a plaster of good figs, and you put it on the back for a poultice, and it draws out the infection. That's what's going to happen in the kingdom. After the physical threat is removed, you're still going to have to deal with that systemic sin. And the ancient worthies, the really good figs, they're going to help Israel draw that sin and that infection out of them. That takes us to 39. And in chapter 39, Hezekiah is very thankful, but he makes a mistake. And that is, there's a king of Babylon. Now, we're introduced to the king of Babylon for the first time. King of Babylon, he sends emissaries over to Hezekiah. He says, I understand that you've just been successfully delivered from the king of Assyria. Whoa, that's something that the king of Babylon would like to know about. So he says, sure, come in, I'll receive your emissaries. He showed him all his treasures, the temple, all the good things. He shouldn't have done that. And Isaiah says, Hezekiah, that was a mistake. All of these treasures you just showed to the Babylonians, they're going to be in Babylon someday. So for the rest of the book, chapters 40 through 46, you find a lot of things that deal with the country of Babylon and the threat they're going to impose. Now that's so different because Babylon really wasn't an empire in the days that Uzziah himself lived. Although in chapter 39, they're warned that they're going to be later. But because of that, I know that there are many commentaries that wonder if maybe the last part of Isaiah really wasn't written by him. It was really written by somebody else at the end. You know, I wondered about that. Is that possible? I don't think so. But I think that's the reason for that. If you ever come stumble across that view, perhaps that's the reason. Because Babylon was a coming problem that later would be involved. And then chapter 66. Well, I have to turn there and just read what has recently become one of my favorite texts. Isaiah 66, because it's another one of these scriptures that clearly has not been fulfilled. This is Isaiah 66, verse 23, second to the last scripture in the book of Isaiah. It shall come to pass that from one new moon to another, and from one Sabbath to another, shall all flesh come to worship before me, saith the Lord. It's never happened. Never happened. It's going to happen. It's right there in God's writing. So this is a precious way to end the book of Isaiah. It kind of reminds you the way it opened. There'll be no more war, ever. Now this text reminds me of Zechariah, the 8th chapter, verse 21, 22, 23, when it says, the people of the world will say, hey, are you going to Jerusalem? I'm going to go. I'll go with you. And they'll race to Jerusalem for their blessing. And then in Zechariah, that takes you on further into the 14th chapter where God delivers Israel. The living waters of life go out half to the Mediterranean Sea, half to the Dead Sea, and there's a refreshing and a benefit to everyone. That gets it back to the Feast of Tabernacles because that's where they're going to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. That'll be the earthly kingdom. That blessing of life that goes in both ways, maybe the Dead Sea represents those who are actually in the grave, they're going to come back. And maybe the Mediterranean Sea, it's still a salt sea, but there's fish living there, you know. Maybe that's the teeming masses of mankind that are living into the kingdom. Now, what was it? In 1925, they expected the kingdom, and there was a publication that millions now living will never die. Well, okay, that's kind of has a bad taste because it didn't happen. But I'm ready to say today, millions now living will never die. I think that actually is going to be true sometime. I think we're to that time. We'll see. So I think there a lot of mankind is going to be ushered into the kingdom and realize things have changed. Okay. We're going to look at a list of prophets that are involved here. Now, we mentioned that the prophet Micah, you see him in red on the first list over there. The prophet Micah and the prophet Joel are both contemporaries of Isaiah. Now, I think they're younger contemporaries of Isaiah because if you look at the years of the kings in which they reigned, which they prophesied, Isaiah started all the way back in Uzziah and the others did not. So I think that Isaiah is the older of them. And when you go to the book of Micah in the third chapter, the fourth chapter, you're going to see something here in Micah, the fourth chapter, that is... Well, let's see now. Maybe I'm getting ahead of ourselves a little bit. Yeah, just a little bit. Hold that thought. Okay, so what we have on the screen for you is a little designation that distinguishes where the prophets lived and what experiences they were undergoing. Now, there are 12 minor prophets. You know that. Now, we have the minor prophets listed on the left side. And we have the major prophets listed next to them. There's Isaiah. Six minor prophets were in his time period. And then after that, in the Babylonian period, we had Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and Daniel. So then after that, in the Persian period, we had Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. So with Isaiah, I think that's why Micah quoted in Micah, the fourth chapter, what Isaiah said in our theme text. So let's turn to Micah just quickly here. See what Micah says, and then we'll have a few comments about this. It's basically the same that we read earlier. Micah, the fourth chapter, starting with verse 1, it shall come to pass in the last days, it shall come to pass that the mountain of the house of the Lord shall be established in the top of the mountains, and it shall be exalted above the hills, and the people shall flow unto it. And many nations shall say, come and let us go up to the mountain of the house of the Lord. He will teach us of his ways, we will walk in his paths. He will judge among the people, and there will be no more war. I'm summarizing just briefly because we read it in Isaiah. That perplexed me a long time ago. I thought, okay, who was first here? But I'm pretty sure Isaiah was first, and Micah is repeating his prophecy. And Joel lived in the same time, and they faced the same threat that Isaiah helped King Hezekiah overcome. Okay. Now, when we look in this text in Micah, you notice it says, in the last days it shall come to pass that the mountain of the house of the Lord shall be established in the top of the mountains. Now, that's also from Isaiah. Do you find that expression anywhere else in the Bible? The top of the mountains. One other place. And that's at the time of Noah and his flood. And I think that that actually points to something in our day. I think it points to the reestablishment of the nation of Israel in our day. Now, let me explain how that could possibly be and how we can designate the one particular event after Noah's flood. You remember that Peter says about the ark, that the ark represents redemption in Christ. This is what 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 20 and 21, he says, that ark was made of what material? Is that made of plastic? Wood, made of wood. Now, from what we said yesterday, you probably know where I'm going. Wood, I think, always represents the wood of the cross. So Peter says, if you're in the ark, if you've been baptized into Christ, then you're in the ark. You're saved. The world outside is still under the curse. The water is sweeping away the world of mankind, but you're safe in the ark. They were in that ark for, Now, the first 40 days it rained. Now, when you get into the ark, you can't get into the ark until Jesus dies and provides the ransom. That would be like 33 AD. It rains for 40 days before the actual intensity of that judgment stops. Is that a day for a year? Is that possible? Let's see, that would take you to 73 AD. That would be the end of the 7 years of the Jewish wars with the Romans, and that was when Masada fell, and that was the end of the Jewish revolt. So I think maybe there's an application. But for 5 months, five is a number that always pertains to the new creation. You want to enter into the holy, you want to start developing as a new creature, you go through the five pillars that open the holy. So maybe those 5 months represent the gospel age. But then you get to the end, and you don't get really to the end of the flood. The water's gone, not quite. But you come to a place where the ark just comes to rest. You look outside, everything looks the same, but you stop moving. So the threat is not gone, the curse is not gone. We're not yet into the kingdom when the curse is no more. It's still there. But we've come to a stopping point. Maybe that stopping point represents the end of the age where we are today. We've come to the prophetic markers. Now, in Daniel, you have all these prophetic markers, the 1260, 1290, 1335. And it's the last one, 1335, that takes you to the harvest in 1874 in the end of the age. Well, could that possibly be a marker for 1874? Well, let's think about the possibility for a moment. Now, it turns out that if you look in Genesis, the 8th chapter, and you look at all these verses, you find a lot of dates put on these various experiences. It came to rest, and then it came to rest, let's see, what was it? In the 7th month on the 13th day of the month, it came to rest. And then on the 10th month, on the very first day of the month, out in the distance they saw, and here's where the expression of Micah comes back, the top of the mountains out in the distance. That's like hope for the future. Something good is coming. When you were in the ark and that's the first time you saw the top of the mountains, you said, finally, we're coming to the end of this cursed flood. And there's going to be some better times coming. Well, how many days involved was that? Well, let's see. It was the 13th of the month. I can demonstrate that each of these months are 30 days. You can find that intrinsically in that chapter. So if that's true, you have 14 days to go before the beginning of month 8. 30 days more to the beginning of month 9. 30 days more to the beginning of month 10. That would be 74 days. 74 days. I better not be mistaking a math mistake here. I'm doing this from memory. I'm sure it's right. 74. Okay, take 1874. Add 74 years onto it. Remember those 40 days? 40 years? Let's try that. Let's add 74. What answer do you get? 1874 and 74. What do you get? 1948. Now, Paul already knows that answer. 1948. Is it possible that this is a little precursor, a little testimony, that what we read about in Isaiah and Micah, the mountain of the house of the Lord should be established in the top of the mountains? Now, we're not yet to the kingdom. The floodwaters are still out there. We see the top of the mountains. We see ocular evidence that the kingdom is on the way. Israel has been reestablished. By the way, how long did it take Israel to be reestablished in 1948? From the time the first Jewish colony in 1878, how many years was that? 70 years. You remember when they lost their national independence to Babylon? How long of an experience was it? 70 years. Now they're restored in 70 years. So maybe there's a double way of identifying 1948. It tells us that we're on the way. But they have to wait for some time more. They have to wait to the first day of the brand new next year coming. On the very first day of the next year, they looked out of the ark, and the waters were gone. The curse is gone. Now, you remember yesterday we talked a little bit about Exodus chapter 40. And we mentioned Exodus 40, you had the tabernacle all set up. And it's all ready to go. But you know, they could have built the tabernacle earlier. God told them, wait until I tell you, and then put it all together. He says, you got all the parts ready, and now, Moses, I want you to go and examine all the parts, make sure all the parts are in good order. Moses did that, he reported, yeah, everything's good. He says, okay, now wait until the first day of the first month of the next new year before you put it all together. Why did God tell him to do that? I think it's because that first day of the first month of the next new year represents a new age in God's plan. I think that beginning of the year represents the beginning of the gospel age. So I kind of think that when in Noah's Ark experience, they waited until the first day of the first month of a brand new year, this is telling us a new age is dawning. Now, of course, we're already in a transition period toward that. But we still see the curse out there. But it was on that first day of the new year, they looked out and all the water was gone. It's all gone. So I think that's the beginning of the kingdom proper. So I think the first thing that we see out on the horizon, 1948, we can put a date to that. We can see that was fulfilled. That gives us the assurance we're on the right track. Now, I know it's been a long time. Well, the brethren thought 1914. Then maybe 1925. Then, what was it, 1952, 54, something. There were various spots, 1980. Oh, I like that date, 1980. Didn't work. I think something did happen there, by the way. I didn't know about it years later. You know that 1980, the Jerusalem Law, was exactly 1845 years after the end of the Bar Kokhba Rebellion? Okay, that's another subject. I just dropped that in there. But I think there was something of value there. But now we're looking for it, and it's going to come. Now, I think almost all the brethren think it's going to come within a lifetime. Now, I thought that when I was a kid. I was baptized when I was 16. My father was baptized when he was 12, so I had nothing on him. But I was baptized when I was 16. And when I was baptized, I said to myself, I won't live to be an old man. Now, maybe you're looking at me now and you realize that prophecy was not fulfilled. I don't feel too old, but my years are increasing. But I actually thought the kingdom would be here before I could be that old. Now I think we've got a few years to go. Now, almost all the brethren think maybe another, I don't know, I don't even want to put a number in your mind. I have a number, you all know that, but I won't put it in your mind. But it's coming. It's coming within a couple of decades, perhaps. And I think we're on the road. But when I see the foundation of Israel, a first demonstration we see on the top of the mountains, it gives me confidence that this is really going to work. Now, do we see that date, 1948, anywhere else? Well, let me go back a little bit to Daniel, the second chapter. This is a chapter that you all know. It's about the image of Gentile power. And this is fundamental to brethren as well, because we all know that this finally ends in the kingdom of Christ. Okay, and Daniel, the second chapter, verse 35. It says, finally, this image is smitten. Then the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver, and the gold were broken to pieces together and became like the chaff of the summer threshing floor, and the wind carried them away. Now notice the two expressions, the summer threshing floor and the wind that carried them away. Now the summer is the time of the harvest. So when is the winter time? Remember what Jesus said in Matthew 24? Pray that your flight not be in the winter. You should be leaving during the summer. We're still in the summer. Well, that means that this image is smitten and this blown away by the winds. Now, that's the other symbol here. You already know what I think about a wind. It's the winds of war. Now, it's my own opinion. And I grew up knowing that there were two opinions. The one opinion that this image was smitten in 1914. And the other is, no, it's still future. To this day, those two opinions are still out there. I'm sorry to introduce a third, but I have a third opinion. And that is that the image was smitten in 1914, and it's gone. It's wiped away. And where are the pieces of it? The pieces were swept away in two world wars. Now, what happens immediately after that? Let's see what happens after the wind carries away the pieces. Well, then, in the last part of verse 35, it says, the wind carried them away, that no place is found for them. And the stone that smote the image became a great mountain and filled up. That stone became, it grew and grew and grew. Have we seen the beginning of that? Maybe in 1948? Okay, we're interpreting here. This is very interpretive. But I kind of think that this image is gone. I think it's gone. I think it's swept away. And I think what we're seeing now is the reestablishment of Israel that had to be after the wind phase, had to be after World War II. Okay, here's another point. Now, you know, my goodness, is that clock right? Oh, boy. Okay, you know that in Ezekiel, the 9th chapter, there is a man with the writer's inkhorn. You know that's there in the 9th chapter. I can just tell you about it. I can't read it. Don't have enough time. You know who that was? All of you probably could tell me. I think that's Pastor Russell. Yeah, I think that's right. But I heard a talk on this by Tom Ruggiero that suggested, as many scriptures do, it has more than one meaning. And that in Jeremiah's day, it referred to Jeremiah the prophet himself. Do you know how long a testimony Jeremiah had before the nation of Israel was swept away? I can give you all the details, but we don't have time. It was 40 years. Exactly 40 years. Now take a parallel out to the harvest messenger. Say in 1874, add 40 years onto that. That would take you to 1914. Hey, that fits pretty well. But wait, Brother also didn't die in 1914. Neither did Jeremiah die at the end of those 40 years. He went with his Israelite brethren into Egypt, and we don't know when he died. So he lingered a little bit. But those 40 years parallel to the 40 years of Brother Russell. Now, if you turn to Daniel, the 7th chapter, with me for just a moment, this is the other picture of the world governments that are going to be established and finally be supplanted by the kingdom of Christ. It says in Daniel 7, verse 1, in the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, he had his dream. Well, I won't go into all the details, but you can put a date on this. By the way, I wish all Christians knew who Belshazzar was, because for a long time, the existence of this king was disputed by skeptics that says that proves Daniel was a fraud. Well, now we know who he was. We got records from him. We know. Okay, here's the point. After Jeremiah, after his 40 years, 34 years later, came this episode, came this first year of Belshazzar. Now, let's take this in a parallel in our day. 1914, let's go 34 years later. 34 years later, 1948? It really is 1948. Okay, so I think we have a double testimony that what we're looking at now on the scene of history with the reestablishment of Israel really is correct. Now, when you get to the book of Isaiah, Isaiah has a lot about the Babylonian Empire that was going to take Israel. Let me see. Let me go. Now, here's Micah 4, 1 through 3. We referred to that a little bit earlier. Okay, let's go forward. Okay, here's just a suggestion from this testimony that might be relevant to when the kingdom is coming. We have in the book of Joel, who is a contemporary of Isaiah, he says in the book in Joel 1, verse 4, here it is up here, what the gnawing locust has left, the swarming locust has eaten. What the swarming locust has left, the creeping locust has eaten. What the creeping locust has left, the stripping locust, there's four. Now, those four, thank you, you're kind, but I'll be quick. Okay. I said walk slow. Thank you. Okay, but here are these four. That's literally what Joel was talking about. These four kings that ravaged the area of Israel. So I think Sennacherib was the last of the four locust powers that came over. Now, what has happened since Israel was reestablished in 1948? What happened in 1948 when they claimed independence? They were invaded by all their Arab neighbors. That was the first war. And then after that, in 1967, now I remember that in 1967. I remember seeing all the newscasters that I was familiar with, Walter Cronkite and David Chet Huntley and David Brinkley, you know, way back, talking about Scripture. Whoa, they were reading Jeremiah publicly. I don't think that would happen today. I wish it would. But I think that was 1967. That was the second war. And the third one, 1973. You know, we haven't had a really severe war in the Middle East for 50 years, whatever it is. It's been a long time. But we're going to have one more. Ezekiel 38 and 39 says we're going to have one more. So if Sennacherib's that invasion and the deliverance from that represent the final deliverance of Israel, I think that's impending. Okay, we have to close. We see the text there before us. It's going to come to pass that the mountain of the house of the Lord will be established in the top of the mountains. It will be exalted above all the others. And the whole world is going to flow unto it. Oh, we look forward to that day. And we're close to that day. Doesn't matter when you think it's coming. You all know it's close. We've got a few more years to go. We have a few more, what does this hymn say? A few more trials. A few more experiences. Let's be faithful as best we're able. And keep watching the eyes of prophecy as closely as we're able. Now I want to end just by saying how blessed it is to see you all. I see you on the screen. Nice to see you in person. Lord bless you.